bonus show today. It looks like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is signaling that he would support a so-called don't say gay bill. It's been years since we've talked about these don't say gay bills, and they're vile. And we're going to talk about it. Also, a record 31 million Americans will be betting on the Super Bowl. Am I one of them? Most of you probably know the answer, but I'll answer it on the bonus show. And also, there is an 85 mile wide comet heading in our direction from the Oort cloud. Not going to hit Earth. I know that there are some people who, for the bonus show, they would do really dishonest things.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money. Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Right. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to pretend maybe this comet is going to hit us. It's not, but it's an interesting story nonetheless. So all of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up now at joinpacman.com. You can use the coupon code WOW22 for a discount.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
With your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music. For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
A major CNN investigation suggests U.S. soldiers opened fire on Afghan civilians last August after a massive suicide bomb blast outside the Kabul International Airport. CNN's report is based on interviews with survivors and doctors in Kabul who contradict a new Pentagon investigation.
There were absolutely no gunshot wounds. During the course of our investigation, we found no evidence that post-blast U.S. service members killed other U.S. service members or Afghans.
We'll speak with CNN's Nick Peyton Walsh, just back from Afghanistan. Then we'll talk to Congressmember Ro Khanna, whose district is in the heart of Silicon Valley. He has a new book, Dignity in the Digital Age, Making Tech Work for All of Us. We'll talk to him about his call for a wealth tax, what's next for Build Back Better, foreign policy, and the hearing he chaired this week calling out fossil fuel companies for failing to meet their pledges to reduce emissions.
As early as the 1970s, Exxon knew not only that climate change is real, but that its products, Exxon's products, were contributing to the climate crisis.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More states have announced plans to relax public health measures as this winter's devastating Omicron wave of coronavirus infections continues to ebb unevenly across the United States. On Wednesday, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker said he'll lift a statewide mask mandate for K through 12 schools at the end of February. Democratic governors in Illinois and Rhode Island also announced they'll roll back mask mandates for indoor public gatherings. Here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul said the lifting of an indoor mask or vaccine mandate today marks a new phase in this pandemic.
Overall cases are down, positivity rates down, hospitalizations are down, cases per 100,000 are down, and new admissions are down. That is a beautiful picture. That may be one of my favorite slides. And vaccines and boosters are up in our hospital capacity. So, New Yorkers, this is what we've been waiting for.
On one Wednesday, the U.S. reported nearly 3,600 new deaths from COVID-19. Hospitalizations remain high, but have dropped below September's peak of infections from the Delta variant. Centers for Disease Control Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said Wednesday her agency is looking into updating and reviewing its guidance.
But at this time, we continue to recommend masking in areas of high and substantial transmission. That's much of the country right now in public indoor settings.
CDC data show more than 99% of counties across the United States are currently considered high risk for transmission. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, Congressional Black Caucus Chair Joyce Beatty says Republican Congressmember Hal Rogers of Kentucky poked her in the back and said, "Kiss my ass," after she asked him to wear a mask aboard the Capitol Building subway system. Beatty said Wednesday she'd accepted Rogers' public apology, but said she felt she might have been treated differently if she were not a black woman. The White House accused Russia of escalating tensions Wednesday as an estimated 30,000 Russian troops begin 10 days of military drills in Belarus. Satellite images appear to show Russian military hardware has been moved closer to the border with Ukraine. Meanwhile, some 3,000 extra U.S. troops have mobilized to Poland and Romania, some of them relocated from Germany. More troops from NATO members countries could follow suit. Former White House senior adviser Peter Navarro said Wednesday he won't comply with a congressional subpoena issued by the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Navarro has openly boasted that he helped create a strategy of delaying Congress's formal count of the 2020 election results to buy time for Donald Trump and his supporters to reverse the election outcome. The Washington Post reports, after Trump lost the 2020 election, Rudy Giuliani and other Trump legal advisors asked a Republican prosecutor in northern Michigan to hand over his county's voting machines to Trump's team. Meanwhile, the National Archives has discovered what it says appeared to be classified information and documents Trump took with him from the White House as he left office. Last month, Trump returned 15 boxes of records from his Mar-a-Lago resort, which he'd taken with him in violation of the Presidential Records Act. Among the documents were letters from Barack Obama and Kim Jong-un. Times reporter Maggie Haberman writes in her new book, Confidence Man, that while Trump was in office, staff periodically discovered wads of printed paper clogging his White House toilet and believed the president had flushed the records. The Biden administration's laid out a $5 billion plan to build a network of electric vehicle charging stations along interstate highways. Money for the program would come from the recently passed $1 trillion infrastructure bill. It's part of the administration's plan to make half of new cars sold in the U.S. by 2030 battery-powered or plug-in electric hybrids. Meanwhile, the House Oversight Subcommittee on the Environment held hearings on the role of major oil companies in funding and disseminating misinformation about the climate crisis. Board members of Shell, Chevron, BP, and ExxonMobil refused congressional requests that they testify at Tuesday's hearing. Instead, lawmakers heard from climate scientists and experts on big oil's public relations efforts. This is Tracy Lewis of the group Public Citizen.
At least 45 years ago, oil industry scientists privately warned their own company executives that their products would spell doom for the planet. Yet, instead of taking action, the fossil fuel industry has used its political power and public messaging capabilities to undercut climate policymaking and climate action, misleading the public about its products and therefore causing well-documented harms.
We will speak with Congressmember Ro Khanna about that committee hearing he chaired this week later in the broadcast. A group of 13 youth climate activists have filed a lawsuit accusing their home state of Virginia of backing fossil fuel projects that contribute to the climate crisis in violation of their constitutional and public trust rights. The plaintiffs are aged 10 to 19. They're represented by Our Children's Trust. In related news, another group of young activists announced their historic climate trial against the state of Montana will begin next February. Human rights experts told a Senate panel Wednesday Congress should take back authority for use of lethal force from the executive branch. The testimony came during the Senate Judiciary Committee's first hearing into the military's use of drones in nearly a decade. Citing the monitoring group Air Wars, committee chair Senator Dick Durbin noted as many as 30,000 civilians had been killed as a result of U.S. coalition airstrikes since that 2013 hearing. This is ACLU attorney Ina Shamsi testifying Wednesday.
Successive presidents have used secretive war-based rules to kill terrorism suspects in places where we weren't or aren't at war. In doing so, they've crossed the lines between wartime and peacetime powers that are essential to the rule of law, to democratic accountability, and the right to life. Despite widespread credible accounts of horrifying civilian deaths, the executive branch kept expanding the program and the categories of groups and people who could be targeted. It used vague and ever-shifting secret legal justifications. If any other country had done this, we would call it unlawful extrajudicial killing. Yet it's a core component of what Americans now call our forever wars.
The Senate committee hearing began when Dick Durbin played a clip of Democracy Now! Of a Yemeni victim of the U.S. drone strikes in Mexico. Three suspects were arrested over the shooting death of longtime Tijuana reporter Lourdes Maldonado López. She was assassinated last month amidst a wave of journalist killings there. In 2019, Maldonado pleaded with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador for help at his daily press conference, telling him, "I fear for my life." California is suing Tesla, accusing the electric car maker of operating a racially segregated workplace at its factory in the San Francisco Bay Area. California's Department of Fair Employment and Housing received hundreds of complaints from black workers at Tesla's Fremont plant who say they were subjected to racial slurs and discriminated against in job assignments, discipline, pay, and promotion. Last year, a federal jury in California ordered Tesla to pay $137 million in damages to Owen Diaz, a black man who suffered racist abuse while working at Tesla as an elevator operator. In Tennessee, recently fired Starbucks workers are speaking out after they were sacked by the coffee chain for organizing a union drive at a Memphis store. The workers say they refuse to be silenced and are calling on Starbucks workers around the country to unionize more locations. In more labor news, our Amazon workers at the Bessemer, Alabama warehouse are voting to unionize for the second time in a mail-in election that began last Friday. The new vote comes after the National Labor Relations Board found Amazon unlawfully interfered with the first election last year. Meanwhile, a new report found Amazon was able to dodge over $5 billion in federal income taxes in 2021. Amazon reported record revenue of $35 billion last year, but benefited from a federal income tax rate of just 6%, thanks to corporate tax breaks. The report was issued by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, which said, quote, "Amazon's strategy for retail dominance rests on two tactics, avoiding taxes and using the savings to finance a slow strangulation of its retail competition," unquote. And Senators Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar have unveiled a bill that would slash prescription drug prices in half. They're calling on Democrats to debate and vote on the legislation. Sanders spoke from the Senate floor Wednesday.
"Let me tell you why we pay the highest prices in the world. Why people in America die because they can't afford prescription drugs. And the answer has everything to do with a corrupt political system in which, over the past 20 years, the pharmaceutical industry has spent over $4.5 billion on lobbying and hundreds of millions of dollars in campaign contributions." Yes, you heard that correctly.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, a major CNN investigation suggests U.S. soldiers opened fire on Afghan civilians last August after a massive suicide bomb blast outside the Kabul International Airport. The Pentagon is denying its claim that it was the soldiers' bullets that killed or wounded many. Stay with us. Search for Peace by Ishmael Ensemble. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Pentagon is facing questions about whether U.S. troops may have shot Afghan civilians following a devastating suicide bombing last year outside the Kabul airport. The questions center on what happened on August 26, 2021, less than 2 weeks after the Taliban seized control of Kabul. At the time, thousands of Afghans were traveling to the Kabul airport, hoping to leave Afghanistan. On August 26, a massive bomb blast exploded outside the airport gates. At least 180 people, including 13 U.S. troops, died that day. The Pentagon says all of the deaths were linked to the blast, but Afghan eyewitnesses tell a different story. There were initial reports of multiple bombers as well as a gunfight outside the airport. The Pentagon spent months investigating what happened. It issued a report last week saying the attack was carried out by a single suicide bomber who detonated a bomb filled with ball bearings. The report also acknowledged U.S. Marines had fired shots, but the Pentagon claims the shots didn't hit anyone. This is Army Brigadier General Lance Curtis speaking Friday.
There were a series of crossing fires to the front of the service members on the ground that created the illusion that there was a complex attack, but there absolutely was not. There were no gunshot wounds. We have universal agreement between the Armed Forces Medical Examiner's Office and also the medical providers on the ground. There were absolutely no gunshot wounds. During the course of our investigation, we found no evidence that post-blast U.S. service members killed other U.S. service members or Afghans.
During the news briefing, Army Brigadier General Lance Curtis acknowledged Pentagon investigators did not speak to a single Afghan civilian about what they witnessed August 26, 2021.
Talking to actual Afghans, very difficult given the current structure of Afghanistan and also the fact that U.S. forces had already left. During the course of our investigation, we did not have an opportunity to speak with Afghans on the ground.
That was Army Brigadier General Lance Curtis Friday. Two new investigations by news outlets are raising questions about the Pentagon's findings. One was published by ProPublica with the organization Alive in Afghanistan. The second was done by CNN, which interviewed 19 survivors who say they saw people shot or were shot themselves. In a moment, we'll be joined by Nick Payton Walsh, CNN's senior international correspondent. But first, let's turn to some of the interviews he conducted with Afghans who survived the August 26th attack.
Nurullah Zakul said he was also in the trench, hit in the head by the blast, and tried to flee with his cousin Sohail.
I told to my cousin, Sohail, run. We ran together when I tried to go climb out from the canal. I succeeded, but I think my cousin escaped. The soldier came directly and they started firing.
When did you find out that Sohail was dead?
In the morning time. When I called my family, is Sohail okay? They said he's murdered.
And how was his body? What were the injuries on his body?
They were just shooted in two bullets, one on head in this side and taken out from this side, and another one on shoulder.
A total of 19 survivors CNN has interviewed said they saw people shot or were shot themselves. The US military said the witnesses we spoke to had, quote, jumbled memories from a concussive event and are doing their best to piece together what their brain is unlikely to remember clearly. The volume of testimony from Afghan survivors, though, does present questions as to how so many witnesses could make such similar claims. Another survivor, Morsal Hamidi, had a bullet injury to the left side of her face, say her records from the Italian hospital in Kabul.
I
realized that the blood is coming from my face, like water of a tap. I was hit by a bullet in my face, in my right jaw here, and the blood extracted from this part of my throat.
We spoke to a doctor who treated patients at Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital, one of the biggest in Kabul. He said he pulled bullets out of four injured patients from the airport that night. He said he found gunshot wounds on many other dead bodies he examined, suggesting the number of people shot may be much higher. He asked we hide his identity for his safety.
There was two kinds of injuries. People burned from the blast with lots of holes in their bodies. But with a gunshot, you can see just one or two holes in the mouth, in the head, in the eye, in the chest. I removed bullets from four or five injured.
That's an excerpt from a major CNN expose. We're joined now by CNN senior international correspondent Nick Peyton Walsh, who spent 4 months investigating what happened outside the Kabul International Airport last August 26. Nick's joining us from London, recently back from Afghanistan. Nick, thanks so much for joining us. This is an explosive expose, to say the least. Can you lay out more about what you found? You even make the point that one of the survivors who was shot in the chest was treated at Walter Reed outside of Washington, D.C., yet the Pentagon continues to deny anyone was injured by bullets.
Well, that's correct. We obtained the hospital records from an evacuee, an Afghan survivor who ended up in Walter Reed Hospital, and can't say much to protect their identity here. But yes, there is an explicit entry in their hospital records of a gunshot wound to the left chest. And this feeds into a pattern of paperwork we obtained, or hospital statements, one from the large emergency hospital Italian run in Kabul, which received nine patients, they said, dead on arrival after the blast, seven with what they said were gunshot wounds, judging by the appearance of the wounds to the head, and two to the chest. We retained records too for two other individuals who said they were shot. And then, of course, there were survivors. You just heard from Morsel Hamidi there, a fairly clear witness who said that she was okay after the explosion and has a medical record saying she then received a bullet wound in her face. One of a number of eyewitnesses who describe a scene of carnage, certainly after the blast, but then are aware of a secondary period in which more people are injured. So you mentioned the 19 there. We spoke to dozens of witnesses to the actual event. It was those 19 who quite specifically said they saw people shot in front of them or were shot themselves.
And Nick, could you explain why it is that CNN decided to conduct its own investigation of the attack?
Some of this emerged from conversations that my colleague Sandy Sidhu and her other colleagues had been having with Afghan civilians in the aftermath of other incidents who were saying, look, something doesn't add up with what occurred at Abbey Gate. And initially after the blast, there were reports in the local media and other media organizations that people were reporting that people had been shot. And there subsequently was denials of that. There's been a changing narrative we've heard over the past months from the Pentagon itself, but there was certainly doubt in my mind as to how a single suicide bomber could be responsible for possibly as many as 200 deaths, certainly in excess of 180 deaths. And so that initially sparked our interest. We began asking forensic blast experts whether they could agree with the idea that one suicide bomber could potentially be responsible for that many deaths. And subsequently, that grew to talking to the families of those lost in this awful incident, and then doctors, and then survivors themselves. So I would say probably the north of 100 interviews carried out for this investigation.
And the what these forensic blast experts told you, two of them said that so many people couldn't have been killed by a suicide attack carried out by only one person. But you spoke to many more forensic blast experts, and it seemed as though there wasn't consensus on whether that was the case.
That's true. The experts we spoke to, they were divided as to whether a device of that size. And I have to tell you, too, the size of the device is purely one defined by the U.S. military from looking at the video and the hallmarks of the blast and comparing it to test explosions done, they assessed from comparing those test explosions that the device was probably 20 pounds in size. In fact, their EOD team only got to the site 13 hours after the blast happened and accepted in a briefing I had at the Pentagon in January that their ability to gather data, gather evidence had been limited by that. So we don't know as much clearly as the Pentagon don't know as much as they'd like to know about the device. But one forensic analyst we took to the scene, Chris Cobb-Smith, who is a war crimes investigator, he used to be a UN weapons inspector. He's got 38 years of experience looking at these things. He saw the damage that the bomb had done. You can still see the charring of an awning behind where the device went off. You can see pockmarks in the concrete around where the device went. His assessment was that the level of damage done to the concrete infrastructure there would suggest that the device could not have been big enough to kill 180 people. Now, that consensus, as I say, there wasn't a consensus. Other experts we spoke to who didn't go to the scene looked at pictures and assessed, well, maybe it could have, in certain conditions, killed that many. Another expert we spoke to looked more at historical comparable incidents and said that this, for a single person-borne IED explosive device, would have made it the most effective by a factor of about four compared to any other historical comparables. So there is certainly a divided opinion here, but the expert we took to the scene was quite clear from what they saw there that it would be impossible, to quote, for that bomb to have killed all the people.
So the Pentagon held their news conference last Friday, February 4th, hours after ProPublica and Alive from Afghanistan released their report that had similar findings. Then you released your report, and during a press briefing yesterday, your colleague, Oren Lieberman, asked Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby whether the Pentagon should further investigate what happened after the Kabul airport suicide bombing in light of your report. This is Pentagon spokesperson Kirby's response.
The investigation, we believe, was comprehensive. It was credible, and it was quite definitive. And, Oren, I think you were here in the room when the investigating team came up here and laid it out for you over the course of an hour or more. Pretty detailed work. And as they said, and I'm quite frankly quoting from their work, the investigation found no definitive proof that anyone was ever hit or killed by gunfire, either U.S. or Afghan. And I think I'd leave it at that.
That's Pentagon spokesperson Kirby responding to CNN. So, Nick Payton-Walsh, you have on the 26th this suicide bombing. And the question is whether the U.S. soldiers opened fire, killing many, wounding others. Or as the Pentagon says, no, everything was as a result of the suicide bombing and that these doctors are confusing ball bearings with bullets. 3 days later, you have the U.S. drone strike that the Pentagon was forced after enormous number of international journalists said they targeted the wrong guy, and they ended up killing 10 people, including 7 children. That was 3 days later. Can you talk about that sequence and the fact that the Pentagon did not speak with, admitted themselves, a single Afghan?
Yes, they have admitted to us during the 2 months of conversations we had with them about our findings that they had not spoken to a single Afghan civilian, and none of the doctors in the hospitals, none of the survivors. This is not an abnormal set of events, and I think it's fair to say that so many of the civilian casualty investigations are often hampered by the fact that the U.S. military activity takes place in an area that's often hostile. So they cannot go back to the scene, look at what occurred from an objective standpoint, interview people around and gather that testimony. That is often left to journalists. And so the U.S. investigation, when they look at those allegations, often relies on video, open source testimony, open source video, and interviews with their own personnel. And that's certainly what occurred here. And look, there is a stark difference between what we heard from speaking to Afghans who were there, Afghans who treated the patients, Afghans who pulled bullets out of four patients, one Afghan doctor, I should say, their conclusions about how this came about, and then the conclusions of a 3.5-month investigation done by the Pentagon in which they interviewed their own personnel. It seems some British personnel too, although we've not been able to see exactly what those British personnel said, and some other civilians too who were involved, it seems, in the treatment of people injured there on the actual airport base itself. So very different sets of evidence here and very different conclusions. And there's not something, I think it's fair to say, when we've looked at previous civilian casualty incidents in the past, that is particularly abnormal because of the nature of how US investigations proceed, what they're able to do, and then what journalists do on the ground in the places where those events have occurred.
Nick, were you able to, in your conversations with civilians at the scene, Afghans, were you able to determine why it is, if it is the case, that U.S. troops opened fire in such a way that they hit so many civilians?
I think it would be wrong for me at this stage to try and ascribe motives to what occurred here. In our investigation, we were very much just trying to establish the facts of what people had seen. But of course, you can imagine a scene of some chaos in the aftermath of the explosion. And indeed, if it was the case that troops at the scene did open fire, then I'm sure there would have been multiple emotional reasons why that could have occurred. But as I say, our investigation was focused on the facts of what happened, what people had seen, and we didn't look at motivations.
We want to thank you very much for... Oh, Nermeen, you have a last question.
Just last, what survivors, you spoke to survivors, what are they calling for? What would they like to see happen?
They just like the truth of what occurred, I think, to be recognised. Many of them are still scared. Many of them were reluctant initially to speak about this. Many of them are still living with the fear of the Taliban in the society that is now Afghanistan. And so I think they simply wanted the recognition of the truth of how the people often close to them who they saw die, died, and also for recognition to what they say they witnessed themselves.
Nick Payton-Walsh, I want to thank you for being with us and for this investigation. CNN senior international correspondent, award-winning investigative reporter. We'll link to your report at democracynow.org as well as the reports of ProPublica and Alive from Afghanistan. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we speak with Congressmember Ro Khanna, whose district is in the heart of Silicon Valley. He's just written a new book, Dignity in the Digital Age, Making Tech Work for All of Us. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We spend the rest of the hour with Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna, whose California district is one of the richest in the United States because it includes Silicon Valley, home to Apple, Google, Intel, Yahoo, eBay, LinkedIn, and Tesla. He has a new book out that lays out how to distribute that wealth more evenly, in part by relocating big tech jobs to rural areas and increasing diversity, wages, and transparency. Congressmember Khanna tweeted yesterday, America's billionaires gained $1 trillion in wealth in 2021. for a 25% gain. Meanwhile, workers' wages were up 9% in December 2021 compared to December 2020 and subject to income tax. Everyone has to pay their fair share. We need a wealth tax, he said. Congressmember Ro Khanna joins us now for more. We'll also talk to you about what's next for Build Back Better and climate legislation, the hearing you just chaired this week, calling out the fossil fuel companies for failing to meet their pledges to reduce emissions. We want to ask you also about Yemen. But let's begin with your book, Dignity in the Digital Age, Making Tech Work for All of Us. So lay out one of the key emphases in this book is the wealth disparity in this country, so much of which you represent in your district, and what needs to be done.
Amy, thank you for having me on. The wealth in my district and the surrounding areas is $11 trillion of market cap. It has gone up 40% during the pandemic, and yet so many Americans in rural communities and Black and brown communities have been left out of the modern economy. They've seen jobs go offshore. They've seen deindustrialization. They've seen their kids have to leave their hometowns, and workers have not shared in this prosperity. The book makes two central arguments that we need to decentralize the opportunities for wealth generation in the modern economy so that people don't have to leave their hometowns to prosper and so that Black and brown communities are included. And that secondly, we need to have workers on boards, workers represented, so that workers are participating in a lot of this digital prosperity. And that means fairly taxing the billionaires and these corporations.
Ro, you also say in the book that we have to move away from the idea that a digital job is about working at Apple or Google or about turning a factory worker into a coder. Explain what digital jobs now consist in and what you see as their future, as you point out, by 2025, that is in just 3 years, there will be 25 million digital jobs.
I mean, that's absolutely right. That's more than the number of manufacturing and construction jobs combined. And we do a disservice when we mythologize these jobs and tell people, oh, you need to become a coder. When I think of these jobs, I think of Intel going to New Albany, Ohio, creating 3,000 manufacturing jobs, 7,000 construction jobs to build the semiconductors. These are high-wage jobs, twice the median average. They often require people who already have technical skills in building new things, in having modern production. They're across the spectrum from manufacturing to retail to healthcare, and they don't often require a college degree. Frankly, they often require 12 months or 16 months of some training and a credential. And the problem is that many communities have been deprived of these high-paying, good jobs or of these productive capabilities in our modern economy.
And what are your concerns about people having been deprived of these opportunities, the present divisions, as you point out, not just economic, but also social and political, between the elite classes, many of whom come from this digital world, many of whom, in fact, you represent in Silicon Valley, the divisions, political, economic, and social, between the elite class and the working class. And what do you think the spread of this digital wealth and these jobs might enable, not just in terms of wealth distribution, but also in terms of people's political orientation?
And if your child also wants to answer that question, feel free, Ro.
We're trying. I'm in my own room. We need to understand that if you care about social justice and racial justice, that you have to look at the wealth generation gap. 10-1 is the gap, as you know, between a Black American and a white American's earning. That gap is increasing because the modern wealth generation engine is excluding so many people from the Black community. one of the things we ought to do is have a goal, have a million Black Americans have these digital jobs by 2025, have a million rural Americans have these jobs. So first, it's an issue of social and racial justice and lowering the dealing with the racial wealth gap. But more fundamentally, right now when Silicon Valley does well, it doesn't mean that Youngstown, Ohio does well. It doesn't mean that South Carolina does well. And so there's a disconnect. What could be possible, and I write about this with Alex Hughes' story in Paintsville, Kentucky, or Lakeisha Lester's story in Clarksdale, Mississippi, is that people could be working on distributed teams. They may be prospering together. Suddenly there's more interconnection in the country, and there's not the stark division if we have these jobs not just concentrated in a few places.
You talk about racial justice, Congressmember Khanna. In our headlines today, we reported that California is suing one of your corporate constituents, Tesla, accusing the electric car maker of operating a racially segregated workplace at its factory in the San Francisco area. California's Department of Fair Employment and Housing received hundreds of complaints from Black workers at Tesla's Fremont plant who say they were subjected to racial slurs and discriminated against in job assignments, discipline, pay and promotion. And then we found out that last year a federal jury in California ordered Tesla to pay one man $137 million in damages, Owen Diaz, a Black man who suffered racist abuse while working at Tesla as an elevator operator. Your response?
Well, it's very concerning. And as a representative of that area, I've been hearing these stories anecdotally for years about the conditions of workers at Tesla. So obviously, those allegations are serious and the judicial process needs to play out. But let me make a more fundamental point on Tesla and why everyone ought to care that they are treating people fairly beyond the law. Tesla is a beneficiary of everyone's tax dollars. If the Obama administration had not given Elon Musk massive loans, Tesla wouldn't exist. And Elon Musk prepaid those loans early so that the government didn't actually get the returns that they would have been entitled to. So given the extraordinary subsidization of Tesla by U.S. taxpayers, we have a particular interest in making sure that they are doing things that are just and in the public benefit. And these reports are very concerning, as is, frankly, their relationship with a lot of the building trades and other hostility to unions.
And you're talking about breaking up Meta. People have to get used to that new company name, right? The company name for Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram. Can you talk about what that would look like?
Well, Amy, as someone with Democracy Now! As a more independent news source, you probably appreciate more than anyone that we ought not to just have two or three social media companies controlling access to information. And what Facebook did in acquiring Instagram, what they did in acquiring WhatsApp, is kill new discursive spaces from emerging. I believe that the best we can do in social media to help facilitate a modern public sphere, to get as close as we can to an ideal deliberation space, is to have a multiplicity, a plurality of discursive spaces. And on that alone, they should never have been allowed to acquire WhatsApp and Instagram, and those should be unwound. Of course, there are more regulations that are needed on privacy, on consumer safety, and on making sure that they aren't hurting the public health or hurting teenagers on Instagram. But there definitely is a lack of adequate antitrust enforcement and regulation.
Bro, can you explain further what you think state governors and city mayors can do to allow tech into their communities and then also respond to the criticism that the tech industry in itself creates massive levels of inequality, and San Francisco is a very good example of that. So why would we think that making tech jobs, digital jobs available elsewhere in the country wouldn't also create comparable levels of inequality?
A very good question. Let me answer the second one first. San Francisco, the planning was poor. And first of all, it was a compact space. There was not enough housing, and it's led to a boom in housing prices, but not an equal pay increase for service workers. So for many service workers, people who are doing the food preparation, the janitors, the bus drivers, the security guards, they've seen their pay not keep up with the explosion in rents. That certainly does not have to be the case in many other places. First of all, in lots of other places, there is a lot of land and property values are depressed. And so having new jobs emerge and having storefronts open and having some appreciation of property values could actually be a good thing, which is why we need a better equilibrium in this digital economy. It would actually help places like my district to lower housing prices and help lift the property values in other places. But second, we also need to make sure that the service workers are treated fairly and with dignity and proper pay. It's important to recognize in this economy, two-thirds of workers don't have anything to do with a laptop or a computer. Many of those workers were the essential workers during the pandemic. They aren't being treated fairly. In some cases, they have an algorithm as a boss, which is worse than even having a human boss. People are at Amazon warehouse factories. They used to make $30. Now they're making $15, $16, $17. So we need to increase their pay. We need to have workers represented on boards. We need to have workers given more respect. And this is why I talk in the book about an essential workers' bill of rights that I did with Senator Warren. And those two aspects, better housing policy, better worker pay policy, are critical to avoid some of the problems in my district of the stark disparities that you talk about.
I wanted to talk about what you've done this week. That is chair the House Oversight Subcommittee on the Environment hearings on the role of major oil companies in funding and disseminating misinformation about the climate crisis. The CEOs didn't show up, but board members of Shell, Chevron, BP and ExxonMobil refused congressional requests that they testify also at Tuesday's hearing. Instead, lawmakers heard from climate scientists and experts on big oil's public relations efforts during the hearing. You questioned climate scientist Michael Mann.
In 2002, former Exxon CEO Lee Raymond said he does not believe, and I quote, that the science establishes the linkage between fossil fuels and warming. Dr. Mann, you're a distinguished climate scientist at Pennsylvania State University in our heartland. Do you think that Lee Raymond's statement that science had not established a link between fossil fuels and climate change in 2002 was accurate?
No, it was thoroughly inaccurate. Even ExxonMobil at that point knew how inaccurate that statement would be.
Do you think it's fair to say that his statement was not consistent with the science as Exxon understood it at the time?
Yeah, that's right. And I would just add that the subsequent CEO of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, who went on to become Donald Trump's Secretary of State, has sort of evolved from denial of the science to insistence that we can just use technology like geoengineering to solve the problem. So there is an evolution there, but even now, we still have a CEO of ExxonMobil denying the importance of meaningful climate action.
So that's world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann, who did testify. Now, I think you've announced that CEOs will testify on International Women's Day, right, March 8th. I don't know if any women are the CEOs of these major oil companies. But can you talk about the significance of them not coming and what you are demanding of them?
So, maybe the CEOs came a few months ago and they testified. And what we heard from Dr. Mann was that one of the testimonies by Darren Woods, the Exxon CEO, was not fully accurate. I mean, Dr. Mann said that Exxon in the past has made statements that were not consistent with Exxon's own understanding of the science. They denied in 2002 that human activity causes climate change. And what I asked in the hearing is for Exxon to at least correct the record. I mean, the goal isn't to trap Darren Woods or these CEOs. The goal is to get them to admit that they made mistakes in the past and commit to change going forward. Now, since we started these hearings, there have been two or three new pledges by each of these companies. Here's what's important to keep in mind. There's a huge, huge difference between the European companies, one of which does have a woman as CEO, and the American companies, Exxon and Chevron. The European companies, BP and Shell, aren't perfect, but at least what they're talking about emissions reduction for all the oil they sell. The American companies are saying, well, we'll reduce the emissions for the oil we produce, but we aren't going to do anything about the oil we actually sell. It would be as if an automaking company says, well, we're going to have fuel efficiency in our plants, but it doesn't matter what the fuel efficiency of the cars themselves are. That's not a good faith effort. We need these companies to say we're going to cut emissions for the actual oil we sell and consumers use.
I wanted to switch gears to a letter that you and about a dozen other House Democrats recently sent to President Biden to stop servicing Saudi warplanes used in deadly attacks against Yemeni civilians. You cited the recent airstrikes on a migrant detention center in Yemen, which killed over 70 people. President Biden had pledged to end U.S. support for offensive operations by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen and all, quote, relevant arms sales. But it then approved the sale of $650 million in air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia, among other sales. You have been a champion of the Yemeni people in Congress. Can you talk about that move and what needs to be done now, how the U.S. is central to this ongoing attack on the Yemeni people, creating what the United Nations has called the greatest humanitarian catastrophe in the world?
Amy, frankly, I've been disappointed in the administration on Yemen. I was hopeful in the beginning when the president came out. He said, we're going to have a new policy. We're not going to continue refueling on offensive strikes. But the reality is that the strikes have continued. The blockade has continued. The Saudis refuse to realize that they've lost the war. And we have leverage that we're not using. We could ground the Saudi Air Force to a halt tomorrow if we stopped supplying them with tires and parts. Instead, we continue to authorize arms sales to the Saudis. We have to be real, tell the Saudis, stop the war. Now, the Houthis aren't blameless. I get that they're firing into the Saudi territory. But our support and our leverage is over the Saudis. And if the Saudis lift the blockade, if they recognize that that war is over, then we can have a diplomatic settlement in Yemen. We can alleviate the extraordinary inflation and famine. And we just aren't being willing to put enough pressure on the Saudis despite having the leverage. So it's a place where you're seeing increasing discontent among progressives in Congress. I know Pramila Jayapal and others are really looking for much bolder action from the administration. And if I could say one sentence, because I heard your earlier report, the excellent reporting on Afghanistan. That is also a concern where Senator Warren and I have, with others, with Chris Murphy, have written to the administration about more transparency on civilian casualties. We're waiting for a full accounting, but certainly I think the reporter from CNN, Nick, was absolutely correct that people are owed the full truth and a full investigation.
And, bro, I'd like to ask now about the developing situation with Russia. The White House accused Russia of escalating tensions Wednesday as an estimated 30,000 Russian troops begin 10 days of military drills in Belarus. Now, you've called for the Biden administration to exhaust all diplomatic efforts with Russia. What do you think those diplomatic efforts should look like? And do you support the threat of devastating sanctions against Russia in the event of any kind of Russian invasion of Ukraine?
I do think here President Biden has handled the situation well. I mean, Putin's threats of aggression, threats of invasion against Ukraine have no basis. No country can threaten the sovereignty of another country. There's absolutely no justification for that. President Biden has said that that will be met with severe consequences, and all of the sanctions that he's outlined targeting Putin himself and the financial sanctions are things that he needs to put on the table to make it clear that this that Putin shouldn't do that, that there is going to be a huge impact if he does it. And I think that that has been effective in deterring Putin. But we need to have a resolution with diplomatic options. And I've said everything there ought to be on the table, including the status of Ukraine and NATO. I believe President Bush made a blunder when he said that we were definitely going to have Ukraine in NATO and then we'd have him follow through. I mean, and there's it seems that there isn't any intention of following through. And so everything needs to be discussed on what will actually secure Ukraine. But that doesn't mean that Putin has any justification for what he's doing, and that has to be met strongly.
Do you agree with Bernie Sanders, who just did a piece in The Guardian, saying, I hear the familiar drumbeats in Washington, the bellicose rhetoric that gets amplified before every war, demanding we must show strength, get tough, not engage in appeasement. And then you have, in their individual capacity, the chair of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, and Congressmember Barbara Lee, calling for restraint, saying we have significant concerns that new troop deployments, sweeping and indiscriminate sanctions, and a flood of hundreds of millions of dollars in lethal weapons will only raise tensions and increase the chance of miscalculation. Do you join them in those concerns?
I certainly join them in the concerns of having increased aid, lethal aid, into that area. That will only inflame the situation. I also join them in the concern that we need restraint, that the last thing the American people want is an escalation which could lead us to some long war in Ukraine with Russia, that that's a very dangerous situation, and no one in this country, or very few people in this country, would want that. There's a reason President Obama didn't send lethal aid into Ukraine and had a greater restraint in his approach. So I do think we should do everything possible not to escalate the situation while having the moral clarity that Putin is in the wrong in this case, that there's simply no justification for the invasion or the threat of invasion.
Ro, we'd like to go back to your book and the story you tell about your maternal grandfather, who was part of Gandhi's Quit India movement, calling for the British to leave India. Could you speak about him and how he inspired you?
Well, Amarnath Vidyalankar is a hero of mine. He spent 15 years in India's independence movement. He's my mother's father. He worked with Lala Lajpat Rai. He was a part of the People's Servant Society and was a secretary to Lala Lajpat Rai. He spent 4 years in jail during the 1940s as part of Quit India. And then he lived to see India be free and be part of India's first parliament. I suppose when I think about his sacrifices, his life far more courageous than anything I've had to go through. When I think of my late colleague John Lewis, his sacrifice, when I think about all of the people who have pushed for human rights and freedoms, it gives me hope of the possibility of us overcoming a lot of the divisions now. The challenges now are daunting, but perhaps not nearly as daunting as things that my grandfather or John Lewis or others have faced.
Can you end by talking about January 6th, the insurrection? The latest news we hear, President Trump flushing paper down the toilet, taking boxes of documents, perhaps some classified, to Mar-a-Lago, defying in that way. And then you have the 100 Congress members not willing to condemn what took place, saying it was just public discourse that should be protected. What you feel we need to learn from this?
It was an appalling statement. The RNC called it legitimate political discourse. Scaling Capitol walls are legitimate political discourse. Waving Confederate flags in the Capitol is legitimate political discourse. I mean, there's been a loss of total perspective. And it is, of course, a shameful day. But what we ought to do is look at all of the causes of it. partly we have to look at the causes of social media, where there were specific targeted threats of assassination. And some of these social media companies like Facebook sat on that, did not give that information to law enforcement. But beyond that, we need accountability, not just of the people who were out there rioting or insurrectionists, but of the strategists, the people who plotted this. We haven't gotten that to them yet, and that's what the commission needs to do.
Ro Khanna, we want to thank you for being with us. The book just out, Dignity in the Digital Age, Making Tech Work for All of Us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is Eric Harrison enjoying some whiskey before breakfast with Mando Richard. Wednesdays at 11 a.m. here at WRCT Pittsburgh. Drink up, yinzers.
Everybody ready?
I'm ready for whiskey before breakfast. Are you? I'm Mando Richard. Thanks so much for tuning in. And yes, indeed, you have caught an eclectic folk music show I call Whiskey Before Breakfast. And we'll start off on the liquored up side of the family. We'll end up on the gospel side of the family. And in between, we'll play a wide variety of music that I know you will enjoy. Hammertown's going to get things started. And when times are hard, you don't have any choice except to become a bootlegger, eh? That's right, the Bootlegger's Blues from Hammertown, right here on Whiskey Before Breakfast.
There ain't no work in the mountains since they shut down the mines. I got a wife and six children, and they're hungry all the time. So I had to find another way, not one that I'm proud of. But the union says it's hopeless, and we can't live on love. We really need some groceries and the rent's way overdue. That's why I've got the bootlegger's blues. Looking over my shoulder, a short step from the long arm of the law. These old mountain roads are dangerous, especially with the load of alcohol. I don't want to make my wife a widow, leave my kids without a dad. I'd rather be in the graveyard than see them starve to death. I got nothing left to what I have to do. That's why I've got the bootlegger. And pride, but they say I can't dig coal no more, and I have to provide. I don't want their welfare, that's all I've got to say. They can stick it where the sun don't shine, as I make my home way. My heart is in this holler, I don't wear no leaving shoes. I'd rather have the bootlegger's blues.
looking over my shoulder, a short step from the long arm of the law. These old mountain roads are dangerous, especially with the load of alcohol. I don't want to make my wife a widow, leave my kids without a dad, but I'd rather be in the graveyard than to see them starve to death. I got nothing left to what I have to do. That's why I've got the bootlegger's blues. I got nothing left to what I have to do. That's why I've got the bootlegger's blues.